going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thanks so much, Capital. It is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett. I'm going to go deep on all things Olympics as we get ready for the Summer Games. I'll be working on them for CBC, but don't worry, this podcast isn't going anywhere. We're going to get you set for the Olympics this year, and really, we can't do that without talking about our women, whether it's in the pool, on the track, on the court. If you look at the projections and various people give us various numbers, and we have a real chance of setting a record for medals at a Summer Games. But certainly if we do, it's going to be because of the strength of the women in our contingent. Around 2/3 of our medals, again, projections, are expected to come from our female teams. And certainly look no further than the pool, where we are the most dominant. So we're going to bounce around different sports, different perspectives in this episode, and talk to four really talented women, whether it's covering sport or being the subjects with which we rise in the Summer Games and cheer. And no better person to start with than Maggie McNeil, an Olympic champion in her own right. And she's got some help on her journey to the 2024 Summer Olympic Games in Paris with the support from Ontario's Quest for Gold program. It's a new campaign with OLG called Sponsored by You, which reinforces that when you, yes, you listening, play with OLG, you help support Ontario summer athletes. And when you look at where a lot of those athletes come from, they come from the province that I'm currently in, Ontario. When you look at the 2020 Tokyo Summer Games, nearly half of our medals came from the province of Ontario. And Maggie McNeil is a great example of when you invest in someone, you never know the heights that they can reach. So shout out to OLG for contributing more than $110 million to the Quest for Gold program, hooking up prospective athletes. And when you look at the numbers, the last four Olympic cycles, 201 Ontario athletes have clinched an Olympic medal. Over 90% of those athletes were beneficiaries of the Quest for Gold program, Maggie McNeil being one of them. And when you look at her quest for more gold, it could come in various events, be it individual or relay. That's what I want to hear from Maggie, how she balances not only training and preparing and competing in those events, but also doing that while getting a master's and going to college. Let's listen to and learn from Maggie McNeil as we go deep on all things Summer Games. So Maggie, I'm sure you're excited to get close to the games, and I'll be covering it this summer. And as I looked at the makeup and the breakdown of athletes by province and by city, the thing that jumped out to me is so many athletes who are medal contenders from the province in Ontario. And just like what we saw, you know, a couple years ago, you being a part of it, so many massive athletes coming out of London, Ontario, specifically. You know, for you, what's it like being amongst that conversation?
I think it's incredible. And a lot of even some of my teammates that I've swum with in the past, they're like, oh, I've never heard of London. And I'm like, well, it's a pretty big city. I mean, I know we're not in GTA, but it's still a pretty big deal. And I think Tokyo definitely reaffirmed that. I mean, we had a Londoner bring Canada into the Olympics in the opening. I won the first gold, and then Damien closed it out. I mean, there were three other golds, I think, in between there as well. So definitely something to be super proud of. And that's why I'm really excited about my sponsorship and partnership with OLG. Just showing that 100% of their profits are reinvested back into Ontario to support athletes like myself. And I think that definitely shows on the international scene.
We talk about support for athletes in Canada and specifically, you know, true amateur athletes. What has that journey been like for you where you win that first gold and there's a bunch of Canadians Googling your name and now you go into these games and you're a household name and you're someone that, you know, brand partners are looking to have a relationship with?
It's still, I think, a surreal moment for me. I mean, obviously with COVID, I think, and being in the NCAA as well for university, like I wasn't really exposed to that kind of thing until after Tokyo. So it's still something I'm getting used to, but I'm really excited to be able to support causes that I'm passionate about and give back to the community.
Talk about the NCAA. You're going to have a lot of Tiger teammates in these games as well. Swimming, certainly, but just across the board. What's the aspect of these games going to be like for you where certainly you're cheering for red and white, but you're looking across the games to see where you can see some purple?
Oh, for sure. And I think that's one of the main things that drew me to the NCAA is because you meet so many people from all over the world and not even, like you said, just swimming. I mean, this year in particular, I've gotten really into LSU women's basketball. Just we've been on fire and it's been incredible. I've always been very kind of swimming focused, but coming here, I've really started to enjoy the college women's basketball aspect. So I know Haley Van Lith for the U.S. is competing. She's the only one I can think of off the top of my head outside of swimming that will be competing there. But even within the swim and diving program, we have, I want to say, at least 7 countries being represented with swimming and diving alone. So it's always great to be able to share these moments with my teammates as well.
Since you're an LSU basketball fan, I assume your WNBA Rookie of the Year vote is going to Angel Reese?
I haven't tuned into much of the WNBA, to be honest. I mean, I'm really excited to see what Angel and Caitlin Clark and everyone is going to do in the WNBA as it kind of gets more attention and becomes a bigger thing in sports. But I'm slowly getting my feet wet as far as watching basketball, and I think college is a great way to start.
I think a lot of people are excited to see you swim on multiple levels. And it's funny in talking to different people who are getting ready to cover the games and looking at, you know, what's ahead of you, when you try to pinpoint, okay, well, where is certainly that for sure gold going to come? Like different people have different opinions, whether it's the obviously 50 meter backstroke, you know, with the world record, the 100 flyer, you know, certainly the 100 meter backstroke. It was going to be super interesting just to see, you know, which Canadian pops their head up first between you and Summer. Do you have different feelings, relationship, anxieties, hopes for the different races? Are they all kind of like your children in a way?
I think definitely the 100 fly is my baby, and more so as of late, just with all the success I've had recently. But I'm just excited to have more of a real experience in Paris. Obviously, with lockdowns and COVID, we couldn't really have that full experience in Tokyo. So I'm just kind of looking more at the big picture, honestly, because I've done everything and achieved everything and more than I thought I would in swimming and what there is to achieve. So, yeah, I'm definitely just trying to enjoy myself and have fun and take in the atmosphere and not focus too much on the outcome, but enjoy the process as well.
When you say you've done everything and more, like, that's something people say. That's literally true. You obviously have the Olympic gold, World Championships, NCAA, Commonwealth, 7 Pan Am medals. And I certainly could understand doing this while, I don't know, studying for a master's. That would seem to be somewhat overwhelming. But you scared some people, upset some people when you alluded to the fact that maybe you might stop training at this level in the near future. How difficult is it just to stay locked in on one cycle and tapering for one games without trying to figure out what the future might hold?
Yeah, and I think the minute we were done in Tokyo, we had a big team meeting and the high performance director of Swimming Canada was like, here's your countdown to Paris. And I think it was really hard in that moment for all of us because we had had one of the most successful Olympics in the history of Canadian swimming, and we were already kind of looking forward to the next game. So although I won't be doing another Olympics, it'll be nice to just continue to swim and not have that pressure and kind of knowing in the back of my mind that, oh, I have to get back in shape and get all my kind of eggs in one basket and figure out how I'm going to get ready to swim in LA. So it'll be nice to just enjoy the sport and kind of go back to the root of why I started doing it and why I love it.
You talk about the difference in these games. What's the contingent going to look like in terms of family coming? Have you figured that out yet?
I think that's the biggest difference for me, honestly. I have 13 family members coming. And I think they were all going to come to Tokyo, but obviously we didn't get that opportunity. And two of my friends are teaching overseas in London, England. So they're going to come by for a session as well. And I've been hearing from different people, from my past teachers and former strength coaches. And they're like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be at swimming and I got tickets. So I can't wait to watch you swim. So it's nice to have that support in the building and closer than 10,000 miles away like it was last time.
Love that you mentioned the teachers, because that's a big part of the journey. You know, congrats on graduating. Another huge milestone for you this summer. Can you put in perspective the physical, emotional, mental toll it is to balance both of those things at the same time?
It's definitely challenging, and honestly, it doesn't get any easier. But doing it for 16 years, I think that was just my life, and that's kind of all I really knew. And the last few months, I've been able to solely focus on training, which has been a nice change. But I always enjoy having school on the side. Not really on the side, because I was getting my master's, but just having something else to keep my mind off of swimming and off of constantly kind of analyzing times and technique and things with the Olympics coming up. So it was great to have during the year, but I'm really glad I've had the last couple months to just hone in on training.
To analyze times, techniques, but also nutrition. It's difficult for students, period, to eat well, never mind student athletes, and doing it on a budget. What were your keys to the diet that you had to find time to make sure you're fueling yourself throughout this process?
I mean, I'm not a super picky eater, and I'm not super, like, I'm not a health freak, which is nice. And I mean, I do enjoy my ice cream, so I'll have a little bit of ice cream at least every day. But yeah, it definitely is hard to kind of cook for yourself and find time for that, as well as just the cost of having to go get groceries and everything like that. So I have learned some techniques over time. Like, there's a certain recipe that I really enjoy that I can make it and it'll last me a couple of days, and I'll go and get the ingredients just for that one thing and then go back to the store, as opposed to getting a bunch of different things all at once and having it go bad in my freezer or in my fridge before I even get around to it. So definitely there are some tips and tricks, but I'm definitely not too strict on what I can or can't eat.
I imagine you have to be pretty strict in terms of maintaining a routine, given, you know, your history with asthma and your leadership in terms of lung health. What has that, both advocacy, but also the personal journey, been like for you?
Yeah, it was a really up and down journey for me. Obviously, I was diagnosed pretty late. I think I was turning 18, so I was almost 18. And at that point, I had dreamed of going to the Olympics for a really long time. And I had been on the junior national team by that point as well. So knowing that my Olympic dream might not be able to come to fruition because I couldn't race my best event, which at that time was the 200 fly. So it was really my asthma that forced me to kind of focus on the shorter distances, which is ironic because that's I've had success in most recently. So I guess I have my asthma to thank for that. But I really just wanted to put out there that everyone should be conscious of their lung health, and your lungs do a lot for you. And that's a message that I really want to put out there, but also for athletes that are just starting their lung health journey, whether it's asthma or something else, that you can still accomplish what you want to. You might have to make some adjustments, but over time, you'll eventually, if you work hard enough and you really want it, you can achieve it still.
You know, there's going to be a bunch of young kids, aspiring athletes that watch the games and are inspired to become more physically active or take up a specific sport. And I'm sure you can relate, at some point there's going to be some things that maybe dismay them or give them a reason to say, okay, well, maybe not me. Obviously the support, from OLG, helps that quest for gold. But what would you say to some of those kids who are looking, you know, to follow your footsteps out of Ontario and go bring home a gold or just find a different avenue in their life?
Yeah, for me, I think growing up, it was really important. And I'm such a proud Londoner and proud Ontarian. And I never really wanted to uproot my life and go move somewhere else to accomplish my goal. And that was something my parents and I had decided really early on. And I'm really grateful that they guided me in that decision. Obviously, I didn't really have any inclination to want to get up and leave my friends or my high school or my elementary school. So for me, it was about finding the resources and being able to do that whilst maintaining and staying in Ontario and in London. So I think that was the biggest thing for me. And even if you come from a smaller city, like there are going to be ways that you can still get everything you need without having to uproot your life and go somewhere else. And I mean, I know people that have and had to give up a lot. And I mean, eventually they did accomplish their dreams. But for me, swimming was important and going to the Olympics was important, but it wasn't more important than giving up my life.
Yeah, well, your life takes you to Paris. So you are going away, but going representing certainly Ontario, Canada. I'm sure you'll be able to treat yourself because some of the best ice cream I've had in the world has been in France. And so get yourself some custard and get yourself some gold. Thanks so much for everything that you do. And looking forward to the next chapter in your crazy journey.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much to Maggie for the time and for everything she does. There's actually a great read on her in Maclean's right now. So go give that a read if you want to hear even more of her story. We'll put that in the hyperlinks of this episode. And shout out to her for everything she does for lung health. If you want more information, you can give them a follow on IG at Lung Health Foundation. You can give her a follow at Mac and Mag, MacNMagg is her handle on IG. And you'll see there that, like our next guest, she's been doing some work with Cheerios as well. So as I mentioned to her, Maggie goes from someone who's getting a little bit of support from people like OLG and the local community in London to now being one of the faces of the games with many brand partnerships. It's important for those partnerships to not just be focused on Olympic athletes, but Paralympic athletes as well, which is why I was really excited to hear that Cindy Ouellette is also a part of the team promoting Cheerios at these games, really promoting it via the Cheerios Summer Games, which is inviting Canadians to celebrate the true Olympic spirit and foster moments of connection. And I wanted to talk to Cindy about the rise of not just basketball in our country, but wheelchair basketball in our country and what success looks like for her and for the team more broadly. Let's go deep with Cindy Ouellette. So Cindy, I'm sure you're starting to check off the dates in the calendar and get prepared both physically, mentally, life-wise for the games. You've been to summer and winter games in the past. How does the experience differ?
Well, actually, it's quite different. Obviously, summer is my main sport, so I'm like pretty used to it. It's going to be my fifth summer Paralympic. And that winter one was a super humbling experience. Cross country skiing is extremely hard. I was not really great at it, but it was really like just to challenge myself. So I'm glad I did it. Obviously, like smaller team, it's winter, there's snow versus summer. I'm in a team sport and then it's super pretty outside. So it's quite different.
You talk about the feat of being able to go to five Paralympic Games. Have the games, the way we talk about them, cover them, support them, have you seen changes from your first games to now getting ready for Paris?
Definitely. Like my first game back in 2008. So quite a long time ago. But yeah, no, my first game in Beijing 2008 had barely any coverage. Like I remember it was super hard to watch my game at home. Luckily, I had my parents there with me. But I remember my friend had a hard time. And even in the news, like we barely heard anything. And then when it came on, I think 2012 was a big turning point in for Paralympic Games in London. There was a lot of media coverage. CBC got on board with us. And then, yeah, so now on Jam app, everybody's going to be able to watch every single game that I'm going to play. And even on the news, you hear so many stories about great Paralympians everywhere in the world. So yeah, definitely a change a lot.
Why do you think we've seen that change? Do you think there is a specific differentiator that has got us to the place we're at now?
Well, I think like definitely there was great Paralympian advocate. Like in Canada, we had Chantal Petitclerc that won I don't know how many Paralympic medals. So obviously, I think our country had to recognize her. And then from there, I think people realized that Paralympian athletes are simply athletes with a disability. Before, like our story was a lot about our disability. Now it's a lot about what we can accomplish in our sports. So I think that change of wind was just like, hey, they're athletes too. They represent Canada. We do the same job as the Olympian. So why not talk about them as well?
In Canada, all amateur athletes, you know, no matter who, sometimes struggle for funding and support. I wonder what that looks like for you as a Paralympian. It seems like, from the outside looking in, you have lots of different partnerships and opportunities for funding. But what's the path been like to navigate to get to that point?
Like, I think Olympian Paralympians are on the same boat for that one. Extremely hard, especially like being a woman with a disability. I think it's a little bit harder even. But I have a great agent that helped me out for the past 5 years, and also like great businesses like General Mills, Toyota, Air Canada is behind us. Like they're just, it's great to have those big business, because before we just didn't exist. It's still really hard. Like we don't make a lot of money, but like we don't have the million and million dollar deal like Nike, NBA player and pro NHL players. But still, like having those business behind us, that's what make it possible for me to keep doing my sports. And yeah, it's pretty great to have them, but still hard on the funding side.
The importance of the corporate sector and those businesses is twofold. One, to support athletes like yourselves, but also it's great for them to provide visibility to their customers and everyone that's following them, which is why I find the Cheerios Summer Games pretty cool. Talk to us about that relationship and what you're looking forward to in that partnership.
Yeah, so it's a brand new partnership with General Mills, who makes the Cheerios box. It's great. They got me on board. I'm the first Paralympian with them. So it shows that this business, like, I have Paralympians at heart. They want to support us. They got on board with the Canadian Paralympic Committee as well, as an individual sponsorship with me, but a fully big commitment with the CPC. And then, yeah, so just being part of this campaign with other Olympians, it's like, hey, I kind of finally made it. We're seen as equal. We have an equal opportunity to showcase our sport. So it's great to have them behind us. And the team is fantastic. Like, I met a lot of them, and they're just so much fun.
Your story is one that's so important to tell and to celebrate, but it's a path that certainly wasn't easy. I imagine, you know, if you're having a difficulty in a match, it doesn't really seem that difficult given everything that you've come through. Are there things that you've been able to learn, you know, given, you know, your health battles in the past that have helped you in everyday life and as an athlete?
Yeah, like for sure, like having cancer is 12 years old and being told that you might have 1 month to live, 2 months, and then going through all the chemios in 2 years, and then being told that you're never gonna walk normal again using mostly a wheelchair. It wasn't easy, but I was young and I had an amazing family that really supported me. And I think you just learn to be super resilient at a young age, and that definitely helped me in my sport. So I'm not a superhuman, I'm just a human. So obviously I have struggled in my everyday life, even on court, I get angry. But yes, when I reflect and I'm like, man, you've been through so much, you learn from it all. So just apply it to your everyday life and keep trying to be as positive as possible. And that's kind of how I see life. Try to live as carpe diem, seize the day is really my motto. So that's what I try to live by.
I can't imagine the mental health toll that, you know, that prognosis and also the path, you know, to recovery and figuring out what life looks like afterwards would take. Was the mental health toll when you were young as a kid, figuring out life throughout, still now, how and when were you impacted?
Well, as a kid, obviously, like being told you got cancer, you don't really realize what's happening. You're too young to know what is cancer and what is death. So having that family just supporting me. But then after that, when I got into high school, got bullied for the way I look, for why I was different. So that was a bit, my first main depression was there. Pretty dark ideas I got into. But then after that, sport came into my life, really kind of saved me and took me through a different sort of emotions. Went down to Alabama to study, California to study as well. So that brought me on. And then COVID kind of hit. And then I went back into what I was when I was little. The stuff I didn't really sort out. Why was I different? Why did I have those dark feeling? And why was it alive? Like, was I am alive? But so it's just a lot of self-work. A lot, still today, every single day, like meditations and breathing exercise. I think about where I come from, what I went through. How can I be better tomorrow? How can I be better today even? I think like personal work, like self-work is super important and it's part of my everyday practice. And that's what helped me being a better athlete, I think.
I know you have a love for music and it's self-evident with the grand piano behind you. How has your relationship with music helped you through those times, and how does it help you get in the zone as an athlete?
Like music's been part of my life since I'm like born. I think like my grandparents are musician, my parents love music. I got about 200 vinyl player in front of me. So I play piano since I'm 3 years old, and then when the cancer hit, actually at the hospital, somebody brought me a small piano because I was in a bed for about a year and a half. So I played piano, so that I didn't have any sport. I didn't have, we didn't have Wi-Fi back in 2000. So I play a lot of piano, read a lot. Music's just always been my best personal help I can dream of. Even to this day, I listen to music every single day, before games, even after games. Like, I don't know, you can just find so much comfort in music. There's so many different styles. Depending on how you feel, you can be upbeat, you can be more sad, you can listen to lyrics. There's so many different languages. Music has a wide variety of emotion that you can go dig into.
You know, our Canadian music scene has been on a rise. At the same time, so has our Canadian basketball scene. When we talk about the rise of Canada basketball, that's not just the men's and senior women's national team, it's 3x3, it's wheelchair as well. What is it like, you know, for you at this golden age of basketball in our country, from participation to interest to performance?
It's great, obviously, like following a lot of the women's game this year. I don't know much about the whole NBA scene because I have a lot going on, but it's super great to see there's a new WNBA team, women's team that's coming here in Canada. It's just a great era. It's great to see that more kids love our sport. It was especially in Quebec City, we're not a big basketball town, and it's starting to really grow with some great Montreal players. Find it super lucky and super humbling.
And what does it mean to you, you know, to have this opportunity once again to represent Canada in Paris?
Every single time you get to just wear that jersey, you walk in the the changing room, you see your jersey and you know you're going to put that red and white jersey. It's unique. Every time you get to represent Canada, it's such a big event. Every single time it's going to be different. Every single Paralympic was super different. But once again, like you think about the people back home, you think about your country, you think about all those great businesses that support you throughout the year, your family, your friend. And that's for them that you're going to put that jersey and try to win and play as hard as possible. Same thing when you walk in the opening stadium ceremony, it's just a vibe that you can't really put into words because there's so much emotion. And also it reflects the past 4 years of work that you put into 2 weeks of competition. So it's pretty crazy experience, but it's always super great.
Have you thought past these games yet to determine if this is going to be your last experience?
I got that question quite a bit. So I'm getting old. I'm 35. Don't know yet for real. I'm going year by year after that. Like I'm not looking if I'm doing another full quad until LA 2028. I'm looking maybe for, first of all, the Winter Paralympic 2026. See if I can have a role somewhere with the Canadian team. I'm not sure where, how yet. But and then, yeah, just year by year, see my body, if it's still holding up. How finishing, like if I do more work for some businesses in my own company with my parents, and we'll see.
Well, we're so thankful as Canadians that we've had you for this long. So we'll take you for as long as you're willing to continue to represent the country, to provide representation, and to also to provide others inspiration as well. I'm going to be up early, given the time difference, with my Cheerios, eating breakfast, watching and cheering. So thank you for everything you do, and good luck.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Cindy. You can give her a follow as well. At Couellet07 is the handle on IG, Couellet07. And if you're online, get involved in the Cheerios games. Hashtag Cheerios sweepstakes for a chance to win exciting prizes, including a custom Cheerios box, and tag Cheerios.ca on Instagram or TikTok, as hopefully you and your family are getting engaged in the Cheerios challenge and being inspired by not only Maggie McNeil and Cindy Ouellette, but the other Cheerios athletes like Aaron Brown and friend of the show Damian Warner as well. We'll take a break there for you to go get your Cheerios and set up your five activities that you're going to do in the Cheerios games in the backyard. And afterwards, we're going to talk to two people covering the games, telling the stories of the athletes we just spoke about, and giving a perspective on them that maybe you haven't heard yet, but you certainly need to. So we'll go deep. Stay with us.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. It is the Going Deep podcast, and I posted this on social, but I'm super excited to be part of CBC's Olympic coverage because of what it means to me and family. My grandparents moved here in the 60s, and a big way they assimilated was through sport, and that's how they showed their patriotism, cheering for Canada in various events like the Olympics. And I've talked in the past about, you know, me as a young Black Canadian with Jamaican heritage, what it meant to see, you know, Donovan Bailey win on those Saturday nights and Don Whitman having those amazing calls. And so it's real cool for me to be a part of that coverage. And it's real cool for someone with a somewhat similar background and story, but also provides perspective for all Canadians to be a part of it. And that is Shereen Ahmed, who does a great job for CBC throughout the year. Her Joy Drop newsletter, while really hard to put together, was a very easy read, and she's going to be easy watch during CBC's Olympic coverage. I want to get her perspective on the games more broadly, and specifically our women's national team in soccer, where she's going to be part of the broadcast team. So Shereen, super excited for you and for me selfishly, because I get to say that I'm your teammate and I don't just get to consume your content, but I get to see the process of it being created. But I'm really excited for you to bring us your fresh perspective on our women's national team above all things else, because I think that for me is the operative word in fresh. Like, I know they're defending Olympic champions, but that means nothing to me because you can't lose the previous gold. You can't really need to defend it that much. And it's a different team. And more importantly, the sport, even though it wasn't that long ago, I think on the women's side is so much more advanced. When you look at this bracket and tournament, but specifically this side that Bev Priestman has picked, what sticks out to you?
Well, I love that you said it's fresh, because that's one thing I think I'm really focusing on, the fact that it's a new iteration of the team, and something the players talk about quite a lot is the fact that it's not, it is really, really fresh. You have fresh legs, you have young blood, you have all these things that are making up, which is something that, to be honest with you, I might have been worried about, because the state of development teams was under question support for that system in this country. So, and for the men's side as well, it's not just the women's. I mean, Jesse March just said that one of the problems with Canada was, you know, Moise Bonito wasn't even recognized until he was 23 as a player. So like, that is a problem when, you know, like England's out there. I mean, I don't love England. Some things they do right, but like, you identify players when they're young. Like, you know, Lamine Yamal is 17 years old and he's like taken, swept through Spain. I want that for Canada. I think we have talent here. I think there is an incredible amount of love for this sport. I think that our different communities in this country are so deeply connected to soccer that hasn't been capitalized on enough. And with the senior team for the women, you have a mix of beautiful expertise. You've got Kadisha Buchanan, who was literally the OG. Like, she was awarded 2015 Young Player of the Tournament. She is world class. Like, our back line is literally world class. But then you've got Jade Rose, and it's Jade's first time at this rodeo, actually. She was injured, couldn't attend the Women's World Cup, so it's her first time. But she is actually captain of Harvard's team. So although she's not seasoned in mega tournaments, she's a very experienced player. And you've got that mix. Then you've got Kaylin Sheridan in the back. And I've been really lucky. I've been speaking with these players almost every day for 2 weeks, like different iterations of players. Like yesterday, I spoke with Kaylin Sheridan and Kadisha Buchanan in preparation for my role with CBC Olympics. And, you know, just hearing them speak and hearing them talk, and the authenticity is still there, Donovan. I asked Vanessa Gilles about the election situation in France. I asked Kaylin Sheridan about all the shenanigans and the drama that's happening at San Diego Wave. And they both answer very sincerely. And they're a really smart group of players. Like, they're intelligent people and very tuned in to what's happening in the world around them. And that hasn't changed. That's always been part of the culture. But to see that continue and the camaraderie continue in the team is wonderful, is important. But, and I think it's something that Canadians are not necessarily tuned into with this team. I don't think they realize what a special group of players that we actually have.
So much there I want to follow up on. Let me be a formation geek before I become a human rights geek and talk about this side in terms of how are they going to set up? How are they going to play? The interesting thing is there is more fluidity and flexibility with this group in terms of how you play with and without possession. I felt, mentioned fresh, I felt, you know, at the end, and you will never hear me fix my lips to say a bad word about Christine Sinclair, but I felt by the end, in the final third, players were looking to maybe play off her and set her up and not looking, you know, to be ruthless in front of goal. And I think that dynamic is removed. But who the hell cares what I think, Shereen? What do you think in terms of what we might see, you know, tactically from Bev Priestman?
The thing is, they're playing in a new system. And when I spoke with Bev a couple, like maybe last week, she spoke a lot about one of the things that was important in actually selecting the team, and this after the roster was posted, because don't forget, it's 18 players and then 4 alternates. So adaptability in terms of the new system and recovery. So those athleticism, speed, like fitness are huge components, because a lot of people were actually asking about Sydney Collins as opposed to Gabby Carl, who is an alternate and not on the team, and how is that possible, right? Like, how is that possible? Sydney Collins is showing fitness. She's like really, really fit. And so is Nichelle Prince, who actually just scored the other day against Australia in a friendly. So that was really important. Now, in terms of setting them up, you've in this initial group stage, which is not the group of death, by the way, where Canada is not in the group of death. We're playing against New Zealand first, then France, then Colombia. And then you've got 3 very different teams. So, like, I think France has very sharp attackers. They really, really do. But when you're looking for Colombia, who Canada has actually not played since 2012 in a pre-Olympic friendly, that's a long time. And that's a completely different team than they have now. It's almost like you have to expect the unexpected, and that's what they're expecting. So in terms of how Bev is going to put them, is going to be very much relying on data, on the analytics of the other teams and how they attack and how they defend, which is how the team will respond. A lot of the senior players I spoke to, the vets were talking about how the support staff gets the data for them. The assistant coaches get that data. And Kaylin Sheridan said that specifically. She relies heavily on that kind of information. And so it'll be a very educated formation, whether it's, you know, 4-4-2 or 4-3-3. It depends on who's coming. My personal belief is in the first match against New Zealand, where, I mean, FIFA rankings are sort of like, they're arbitrary to some degree, because like Canada was in the 40s, and look at them at Copa, for example. I'm talking about the men now. So they really are arbitrary, but to a degree. Canada is not going to pretend like New Zealand isn't going to be a challenge. They're there for a reason, right? They're at the Olympics. They qualified for this tournament. So the way that Canada may approach that, and they also have bigger players up front, New Zealand, will be possibly, but they're not as much as an attacking threat at, let's say, France is. And like, to set up that way will be different. And then definitely in terms of Colombia, I would be shocked if Bev doesn't have 4 on the back for Colombia. I would be shocked, just because they're very persistent and they're relentless. It's a completely different style of football, right? So I think that's one of the things that I'm looking out for, of how will they be set up. Depends who they're playing, depends what the game plan is. And Kaylin Sheridan actually said that, and I believe firmly sticking to the game plan will be very, very important here. It'll be essential based on the information. Canada's prepping hard, like they're nerding out in terms of preparation.
It's sad, but somewhat of a reality, that at major tournaments, along with trying to achieve, often what you're trying to achieve is some equality. That you can't just lift a trophy. You need to have some bloodshed for the greater good. I saw the anniversary of the 99ers, which brought me back to what they were fighting for. There's literally a Netflix documentary about the women's national team and the pressure that they were playing, not just on the pitch, but in terms of what they were fighting for. We just came through a World Cup where, you know, Spain lifts a trophy and they're also harassed by officials within their own federation. Like, you can't just have nice things if you're a female footballer. Which brings me to the fact that conversations coming out of the last Olympics, hovering over the She Believes Cup and the last World Cup, were the women's national team fighting for their own equality. And because they were kind of out of sight, out of mind, that conversation in the public quieted down when they weren't speaking in the nation's capital. But where are we now in terms of that conversation? Has there been any sort of reparations, or at least rectifying of a scenario that seems to be going on as long as the women's national team has formed a PA?
So here's the thing. The national team is actually in litigation against former board members of Canada Soccer. So they can't speak on it because it's literally in litigation, it's in process, and it's live. So when my sort of process as a journalist is, until I get an email from the comms people at Canada Soccer to not ask something, I'm asking. Everything is on the table. This is the one thing that even Jessie Fleming herself will say, I can't talk about this. And she's really chill. She's like, I can't talk about this. You know, I can't talk about this. She doesn't even say that much. She'll just be like, I can't talk about this. And that's it. And you leave it alone. So as far as like we are right now today, it is in process. I think the fact that that action is pursuing is to say that this team is not, they're focused on where they are on the pitch, but they're not, they haven't lost sight of where they need to be and what that sense of justice is off the pitch, because they haven't got it. I mean, it's still in shambles. Like Canada Soccer is still tied to the CSB business, which is like, you literally need a chart to understand, you know, that GIF of Winona Ryder and just kind of understand. That's when I look at it, I'm a sports journalist. I need someone to sit down and be like, this is what it is. And it, very simply put for your listeners, corporate spots, like CSB signed this deal with Canada Soccer. So even if CIBC, like they showcase the hell out of this team, the women don't get, Canada Soccer doesn't get a penny. It all goes to CSB. So the big corporate sponsors and CSB benefit from this. So Canada Soccer and the players themselves don't. So that's like a very, very simple explanation, very simplified. It's more complex than that. But at the end of the day, if there's prize money, for example, that's something that the players can get that doesn't go. So prize money and qualifying money and all these things, like the men in Copa, they're getting something like, I think it's, I'm not sure, but I think it's $4 million that they're getting. That is not going to go to CSB. That goes to the players and goes it, like for two of it is, I think, for Canada Soccer, and two is it to the players directly. So what does that look like? I have questions. Like, will the women see any of that? But at the moment, you know what I mean? They can't really talk about it. So that's kind of where we are right now. But I, rest assured, journalists haven't forgotten that, and those questions need to be posed. And I ran into some people from Canada Soccer yesterday, and I was like, yeah, I know you're just back from Copa and probably exhausted and broken from this incredible tournament, but I got questions I gotta ask. So I'm on it. I'll find out.
I know you will. In all things, as a journalist, you follow the money. And it's sad that coming out of winning a gold medal in Tokyo, the immediate response was, all right, we need a women's domestic league. But we finally are getting there. What would a good performance in Paris do for the start of the NSL from a financial standpoint, engaging corporate Canada?
Actually, that's a really good question. And I think part of the success of getting off the NSL was because of the gold medal. I don't think that not a great performance will hinder anything, because as we know, the Women's World Cup was not a great performance. They didn't make it out of the group stages. So I think that the product is not just about this national team. It's about the development at home towards the national team and younger players and what they see and playing professionally at home, not just for the growth of the game, but for players themselves and the growth within and their aspirations, their dreams to be able to play at home. And what a big deal that is. I mean, we're the only top 10 country ranked FIFA who doesn't have a domestic league. Like, it's embarrassing. And before the PWHL, we didn't have a hockey one either. So, you know, and then basketball, now there's an expansion team, but like women's sports in Canada are very, very far behind other countries whom are our peers. We're far behind, and it's not acceptable. I mean, the fact that we didn't have a hockey team was quite frankly criminal. But, you know, same thing with soccer. Like, how is this possible? And if you remember, and this is really interesting, after the gold medal, Steph Labbe and Christine Sinclair went on CBC and with their gold medals, shiny and new, literally said, we need a domestic women's team. It's the first thing they said. And, you know, it was really funny because after the men were finished in their, I can't remember if Estacquio said it after the third place match or whether it was before that, said that we have to look to the CPL to help develop players in Canada, said basically the same thing. I'm pretty sure it was after the third place match. But so you've got players who are doing unprecedented things in Canada, then going live on television going, we need to help develop the development systems at home. So to answer your question, irrespective of the result, I think a gold medal will be amazing for everyone's psyche and everyone's ego, but also it's the fact that it's not going to be easy to defend a gold medal is actually not a bad thing for the growth of women's and globalization of women's football. I think it's really important. The fact that it's not just the US dominating anymore is great. I love to see European teams, Oceanic teams doing well, South American teams doing well, African teams doing well. I mean, you've got Nigeria and Zambia, and from Zambia, you've got Barbara Banda, who's amazing and a superstar. But like, I like to see that. We need to see it. We don't want stagnant, you know, we don't want the game to be stagnant. So I'm excited. And, you know, the fact that the players on Team Canada are very aware of that. And they know that they're playing against like the best in the world is important, and it's fantastic.
What's important and fantastic is that you're not just going to be writing and typing away on your keyboard. You're going to be on our screens in HD, part of the broadcast team with lots of room to play, not just talking about women's sport or not just talking about soccer necessarily. When you look at these games, you know, in France, there are so many, you know, potential directions to go in terms of the conversation, whether it is, you mentioned, the political scenario in the country right now and the amount of upcoming elections for competing nations where there is a real far-right threat, if you will, and will athletes have a stance on said things? Obviously, you know, ongoing conversation, you know, in that country and others is the ability for athletes to wear hijab. There is the conversation around Russian athletes and what do you do with them, even though, you know, theoretically they're competing under a neutral flag. And that's just to start, never mind. What are you curious to see not only happens, but is a driver of conversation by athlete, media, and fans?
For me, it's always been about athlete activism and drawing attention. And I'm somebody who's been historically pretty critical of Olympic systems and stuff like that, which doesn't preclude me from supporting athletes and supporting sport and amateur sport. It's very important to me. And I think there's different things like, oh my goodness, Donovan, there's going to be so many issues that come up, whether it's like the effects, the environmental effects or climate change at the Olympics and what that looks like. It's not just about France, and Amnesty International just released a report yesterday on this. I'm writing my column this week about the fact that it's gender parity at these games, but you're excluding an entire sector of that gender, right? If Muslim athletes who want to wear hijab in France can't play, like, how are you toting this as gender, but like, how are you toting, it sounds a lot like this like icky Western white feminism to me. Like, if you're literally targeting brown and black athletes who want bodily agency and should be able to wear what they want, it's bizarre to me that this is like being overlooked in the way that it has. So I'm definitely tuned in and dialed into that entire scene. There's also a beach volleyball player from the Netherlands who's made the team who was convicted of child rape. And that has become such an intense debate. While he has done time for this, the federation, from the Dutch federation, is like, no, we support this athlete. But there's so many, you know, athlete groups that are out there. The Sports Examiner is one of those groups. It's an ethical, it's sort of like a think tank of sports ethicists that are like, this is problematic. And then to have the discussion around that, what do you do? I'm also looking at athlete activism. And, you know, we're in a world situation right now. There's trauma and devastation in Congo, Sudan, and Palestine. And just to clarify for people, although countries may not recognize Palestine as a state, sport does. Absolutely does. And there will be athletes there who are Palestinian that don't live in Palestine, but they are either from a different part of Palestine, not Gaza, but around the world representing it. And they're not flying under the refugee. They're not competing under the refugee flag. They're competing under Palestine. So a lot of people don't understand that they are actually within the sports world very, very much recognized. So there'll be tension is I think the appropriate word around that, and to see, and it's something that the IOC has absolutely not addressed. It hasn't talked about this. It hasn't talked about the accusations that Afghanistan has gender apartheid. How is Afghanistan going? They don't even let women get educated, let alone play sport. These are topics that I am ready to talk about. That is my wheelhouse, and they will show up. Like, I have watched, like, I'm old. I'm older than you, Donovan. Let's not be polite about this. I'm old. And I have seen so many Olympics where athletes get bolder and bolder, and they tell their own stories and they share opinions. And I know that previously they were discouraged from doing so, but this idea that sports isn't political is a farce, and we know that. And I'm seeing it. We will see it. Whether it's people in the stands holding up flags, whether it's athletes themselves holding up flags or supporting some kind of messaging, but there's also issues of like very severe ways in which trans athletes are discriminated against unjustly. And there will be a trans athlete competing in long distance running for the United States, and to see the rhetoric around that. And will the players be safe? I'm very much hoping and looking at that. Will they be able to compete safely for themselves and in that space and their teams? There's so many things. Like, Dr. Jules Boykoff is a friend of mine and someone that writes a lot about this, and has said this is the most politically charged games in decades.
That's quite the statement. What I love about you is there, when we're talking about these issues, there are some that are nuanced, and there's lots of differing perspectives based off your sensibilities in an area of gray. And there are some that are just black and white. And your ability to effectively communicate the difference is the differentiator between you and the rest of us idiots who just go on and talk on TV. So, looking forward to you doing that for 17 days or whatever it is. And lastly, and I don't know if, you know, you got some exclusives you want to keep, you know, under the hood, or if you are free to promote, so that, you know, not that we need to make CBC's audience any bigger, but that people make sure to catch you. Can you just give us a little glimpse as to what you have in store for us?
Donovan, we're colleagues and we're friends, but I've never actually worked alongside you in this capacity. And I am really excited to be doing that and in creating and telling wonderful stories. Like, you're part of that team. And I'm so excited. Like, when I found out you were on that team, I was like really excited, even though we all know it's no secret. I love your wife more than you, but I'm so happy to be on your team, which is awesome. I am really excited about that. I'm also going to be, as you mentioned, on the broadcast panel with Andy Petrillo and Amy Walsh. Amy Walsh, absolute legends, and so generous with her talent and knowledge. I'm so excited. I've never done broadcast before, so I'm a little bit nervous, you know, because, you know, I'm excited and absolutely thrilled. Because, I mean, you know about broadcast, Donovan. You're so good at it. You have to be hot and smart at the same time. And I'm just like, can I do that? Do I have the capacity to do that? So we'll see. It'll be great. And I'm also going to shout out my better half, Mark Strong, is doing a show with Jem every night called Olympic FOMO. And I'm really excited because I've actually never worked in that orbit with him either. So it'll be, you will be really cutesy in the building. Will be irritating, I'm sure. But no, we'll both be really, really busy. So I'm excited about that. Like, it's going to be, this Olympics for me is, and being able to do in this capacity what I do is an absolute dream come true, truly. And I'm really happy to be on assignment in Toronto.
Love it. We just need to dream a little bit bigger so the role is even more expanded come LA in the summer games. But I'm glad that we've got as much of you on various platforms as we do. Thank you for spending what is very expensive capital for you right now, and that's your disposable time with me on this little podcast. And I can't wait to get started with you.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Thank you for having me, Donovan.
Thanks so much to Shireen. Give her a follow at @ShireenAhmed_ on Twitter, @FootyBedSheets on IG. ShireenAhmed.com is her site where you can find all of her content. And if you're looking for it to pop up digitally, CBC Sports is the handle where you can get all of the great content that she's producing. Thinking of great content being produced around these games, the same is true for our last guest on this episode, last but certainly not least, and that is Alan Hislop, who is the co-founder and content creator for The Gist, both Gist Canada and Gist USA. Well, I guess it's going to be Gist France because she's going to the games in Paris. Really excited about what she's going to be working on, but also I'm interested to hear how she feels about the fact that more people are contributing and creating content around women's sport, even though not all of that content lives up to the great level of athletes we see in the women's game in North America and around the world. So let's go deep, Gist style, right now with Ellen. So Ellen, there's so much I want to talk to you about, specifically around performances of female athletes this summer leading into Olympic Games, which is going to be, you know, pretty groundbreaking for female sport. But I just want to go backwards a little bit and get your perspective on what the dialogue has been like for you to watch in all things women's sport. I mean, certainly the starkest example would be the Caitlin Clark conversation, which has become, like, in some ways, like, political, and in some ways a non-starter for people. For me as a fan of the sport, it's almost made me have an aversion to all things, because I know it's going to come with people co-opting her success for their own game or just playing some terrible takes. But I'm so curious, for someone who works in the space and has helped grow the space, what have you found it been like to see what it's like when there is more attention and more eyeballs?
Yeah, well, first, Donovan, thanks so much for having me on. It's always great to chat with you, and I love how thoughtful and intersectional your questions are. So I really appreciate this one. I think it's been so awesome to feel like we are truly settled into the movement that is people paying attention to women's sports and people paying attention to female athletes. I think that this has been a long time coming, kind of dating back to the Billie Jean King era, where she was fighting for equal pay with the US Open, dating back to Title IX of what we saw in the US of having equal opportunity for men's and women's students in athletics. And now I think everything that we're seeing with Caitlin Clark is really off the back of decades of work of women previously trying to move sports to the place where they want it to go. We talk about this on our podcast a lot, and our podcast is called The Gist of It. And one of the things that my co-host and I say is that, you know what? If Caitlin Clark is going to bring additional eyeballs to the game, let's go. We will take that every single day of the week. I think the biggest thing is that people will come for Caitlin Clark, and they will stay for Asia Wilson. They will stay for Arike Ogunbowale. They will stay for Jonquel Jones, because they're going to look at the WNBA and say, this product is absolutely outstanding. What have I been missing for the last 10 years? And so that, to me, is the exciting part of it.
Yeah. That's a much more optimistic viewpoint than I have, which is factually true. I guess I was become exasperated with men who don't normally pay attention to the sport but have a massive platform and could have used that platform to grow the sport, coming off the top rope with takes that either were misogynistic or just dumb. But I wonder what continual progress looks like, so you can harness this moment right now and help it further the movement for longstanding change, not just in basketball, certainly, but just in women's sport in general. Are there tangible things that can be done to set women's sport up for success? Because it's not every year. The first overall pick in, if we're going to use this example, the WNBA draft, is going to be a transformational player that people want to rally behind and watch.
I really enjoy this question, and I think this conversation more broadly, because I think that there are a lot of things going on in media right now that are great surrounding women's sports. And there's a lot of things that I think, to your point, are pretty ignorant. I think that a lot of us kind of saw what was going on with Stephen A. Smith and Monica McNutt really calling him out on that and saying respectfully he could have been talking about women's sports a lot earlier and storytelling ways in a very different way a lot earlier. And he could have had the platform in order to talk about women's sports. But I think, honestly, because they weren't, that's why the Gist exists. And that's why so many other startups exist, is because there was this white space. When we think about it, I think that a lot of it is education, not only to the fan base, but also, and arguably more important, to a lot of male journalists and to a lot of folks who have a massive platform. And that's totally fair. In the same way that fans are kind of new to the WNBA, a lot of journalists are new to the WNBA, NWSL, women's college hoops, what have you, as well. And what's tough is that so many media organizations, and I think, Donovan, you and I are part of it, is that media companies don't have a ton of money in order to hire so many more journalists to cover all of these sports. And so they're pulling in their MLB reporters to go and cover the WNBA. They're pulling in their MLS reporters to go cover NWSL. And so great that we're getting coverage and that there's new people in the rooms at these kind of post-game pressers. However, these people need to understand that these games are totally different. You cannot compare the NBA to the WNBA. The strategies, the players, what have you, are very different. And we also need them to be able to commit to learning the history of these leagues, of these teams, of these players, because they know all that history on the men's side and how entrenched it is. And if they don't know that history, they're missing out on really amazing storytelling opportunities on the women's side to get people even more engaged. And so I think what we're missing right now is just the, oh yeah, I can do women's sports off the side of my desk, no problem. I've been covering MLS for 15 years. NWSL, easy for me. It's like, no, covering the NWSL actually isn't easy. It is going to take work. It is going to take time. It is going to take education. You do have to develop those relationships, but you are going to see the upside of being able to effectively tell both the men's stories in MLS and the women's stories in something like the NWSL.
Transferring this conversation towards the Olympics, lastly on Caitlin Clark, I actually thought it was a huge missed opportunity that USA Basketball didn't put her on the Olympic team. You can make the argument in terms of meritocracy, and is she one of the best 12 American basketball players in the world? Maybe, maybe not, but one, she's not far away either way, and two, the United States women's team is going to win gold regardless of their 12th player being you or Caitlin Clark. They're going to win gold. So in terms of what it would mean for the game, for the games, for NBC, for everyone, I thought it was a huge missed opportunity. Having said that, I think the best thing for Caitlin Clark is to have a couple weeks of rest and downtime, which the Olympics certainly are not. But how did you view that decision, which obviously became a huge conversation, but you know, at the end of the day, was in some ways a basketball decision, but not in the same way that we're going to take Derek White over Jaylen Brown.
I was really not surprised to not see Caitlin Clark on Team USA. To me, following the WNBA for a long time, seeing the players that they chose, I think all the majority of it makes sense. I think actually Arike not being on the team was a lot more of a surprise to me than not having Caitlin Clark on the team. When I think about Dawn Staley being the coach for Team USA, if there is one coach out there who knows Caitlin Clark, it's Dawn Staley, who has gone up against her in college hoops time after time after time and would have watched so much tape of Caitlin Clark. I think to me, what this just really shows to the fans is that there is a deep bench of American talent that has been in the WNBA for years and that has a different style to Caitlin Clark. And I think one of the biggest things is that when you're setting up this team and when you're thinking of Olympic basketball compared to WNBA basketball as well, it's all about who you need at each position and the chemistry within those people as well. And I think she really did think about, okay, who is versatile, how have they played together beforehand, what do they know about the other countries and other teams. And I don't know, I'm excited for the team. I think that hopefully it lights a little bit of a fire under Caitlin Clark's ass, which I think it already has, for 4 years down the road when she should really fully be having earned that position. I don't know if she's earned it as a player yet to be on Team USA. And so I think if she was that 12th, the flip side would be like, oh, you're just putting her on for the viewership. And I think that Dawn Staley was like, no, she's not there yet.
What's real interesting about the Olympics is whether it's the Just USA, the Just Canada, you know, you don't have to reach to find female storylines. In fact, the faces of the games generally are female, certainly in the Summer Olympics. And for both the United States and Canada, the majority of the medals in team and individual will be won by women. What is it about international competition that brings women's sport to the forefront in that way?
I think that almost takes a little bit more of a zooming out to a certain extent of the women's sports ecosystem. And as a young kid kind of like growing up in the 90s and as a young girl growing up in the 90s and thinking about what sports could mean for me in the future, at least for my demo, there was no place that I could land for myself playing soccer. The NWSL did not exist for me. And so the only thing that someone of my age, I like to call myself a young millennial, but I'm probably just the average millennial. But for someone my age, all you could look up to was the Olympics. That was all that was available. In comparison, when you look for young men, they could play in the NBA, they could play in the NHL, they could play in MLS. They had all these different opportunities to play pro. And so their goal wasn't necessarily to make it to the Olympics. Whereas women, whether it was a team sport or whether it was an individual sport, like a lot of these Olympics were, all of them had the same trajectory of you're going to play in the Olympics, you might not be able to play pro. All of them had the same trajectory of you could probably get a very decent scholarship in the US, whether you're rowing or whether you're playing soccer, and your opportunities outside of college hopefully would mean playing for the national team, but you didn't know if you were going to even have a professional women's soccer team to end up on. I think the only difference was the WNBA. And even then, so many athletes of kind of our age were like, okay, sick, I could play in the WNBA, but then I'm going to get paid 40 G's a year. Versus I could graduate and maybe land a job at, I don't know, a bank and be able to get paid over 100K a year. And so a lot of people selected themselves out, I think, of playing some of these sports. But so what I think we're seeing now is that so many of those women making those decisions really had those Olympic dreams in mind and selected their sports based off of, okay, I'm going to make it to the Olympics. And that was the main thing that they saw, and now they're kind of accomplishing their goals. So I think that zooming out kind of makes sense on that side. And I think swimming is such a big one that we're starting to see so many key athletes really dig into on the US side and the Canadian side, and brands and sponsors really also starting to get behind swimming as a sport too.
Or the other route would be you could just become a media mogul and a startup owner, and you could get to the Olympics that way, which is what you're doing. So evidently you made it. Congrats. So excited for you to, one, be going, two, for you to create some content for me to consume while there. What's the plan? What is the group hoping to do, and what can we expect from the coverage?
Yes, we're so excited. So there are a few of us that are going to be going over to Paris and covering different parts of the game. We are going over with two different partners, with our friends at Canadian Tire. We're hosting 10 Gisters over there for a VIP hospitality experience for the first 5 days of the game. So we're going to be taking in the opening ceremony, skateboarding events, some equestrian events, rugby sevens, tennis, which is going to be so much fun. We're also spending some time with our friends at Adidas place over there. They have Adidas house that we'll be covering. And so what we're really hoping to do is to cover not only what's going on within kind of the Olympic Village side of things and what's happening around the games, but also showcasing what Paris is like during a time like this and what it's like to have all of the energy of the crowds and the athletes walking around and all of these different folks kind of coming in for an event that really only happens every 4 years. I think especially with Paris, we've started to see, and Donovan, you've probably seen this too, but we started to see images come out of like the beach volleyball court in front of the Eiffel Tower. Like, so cool. We're starting to understand what they're doing for the events in the water, whether they're going to be outside or if they have to pivot inside for certain things too. And so I think that there's this like really interesting combination of like historical sites that are hosting these kind of sporting events that I think will be really exciting for us to all take in.
What's going to be exciting too is the amount of medals that Canada can vie for, projected potentially to be a record. And again, 2/3 of those expected to come from our women. I want to know your viewpoint on what our women's national soccer team could do and if they can continue to ride the wave that we've seen, and which has been really a summer of soccer. And I really need the prediction only so that I can know exactly what you're going to be have charting out in your bracket, as that's another cool aspect to your coverage as well.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jonathan. So, you know, it's so interesting. We have kind of the list of the predictions for the Canadian medals, and the women's soccer is not predicted to win a medal. And hopefully that means that they have a chip on their shoulder heading in, considering they've won, they're the defending champs, but then they won 2 bronze medals before that too. So for this not to be a medal year for Canadian soccer feels weird. And as you mentioned, we are launching our very own bracket program at the GIST. We really thought that this was a great opportunity in order to engage this kind of underserved audience that was looking to get more into games that they love, whether it be men's sports or women's sports. And we're really launching it around this idea of a women's summer soccer bracket challenge and digging into everything that's going to be happening and the glory that's happening in France. And so really you can think of it like March Madness bracket, but we're going to be doing the knockout stages essentially for everything that's happening in Paris. And so who I'm kind of looking at, I think, Donovan, as my I want to say like top 3 or 4 probably would be the US, because I really like the changes that new head coach Emma Hayes has instituted. She left Alex Morgan off of the roster, and she's been on the roster for years, and I really liked that move, actually. France, amazing. Hopefully they perform better than their men's team in the most recent Euro. But the French women's team is outstanding. I also love Japan and Germany and their chances as well. I think one thing to keep in mind with women's soccer is that the qualification process is weird. So like some of the best teams in the world are not participating in the Olympics, and this happens every year. Sweden did not qualify. England did not qualify. They are both within the top 5 in the world. And so it's not as a big of a deal as the World Cup, but I think that it's still very indicative of where these teams are sitting at this juncture.
Fascinating stuff. When you see multiple entries, with just various household member names of my house, you know that I'm trying to hedge my bet, because it's a wide open tournament, as you described, even though some of the heavy hitters aren't going to be there. Either way, we're looking forward to seeing your coverage, seeing you break it down, seeing the experience for the Gisters. And once you get back and, you know, the time difference has kind of settled and the jet lag has subsided, it will definitely bother you again to hear all about the experience.
That'd be great. I'd love to pop back on and hopefully cover some of the soccer together too, as Canada, cross our fingers, makes it a very long way through the knockout stage.
Thanks again to Ellen. At the GIST USA, at the GIST CA are the handles. You should follow both. Ellen at the GIST, and that's spelled out, not with an at sign, ELLENATHEGIST is her handle on IG. And on X, I almost said Twitter, at Ellie Hiss, ELLYHYS is her handle there. give her a follow on both. Thank you so much for listening. This has been an Olympic edition of Going Deep. We're going to have more episodes for you right through the Olympics with myself. You'll also hear from our producer, Shoal Lee, who's doing a great job on all things Blue Jays and Jays Talk, by the way. Give him a follow at SNS Ali on X, and let us know what you want to hear and who you want to hear from. As always, please like, favorite, share, subscribe. If you're going to go and give stars, might as well make them five. But thanks for listening. Appreciate it. Talk soon.